I'd like to take a few moments to introduce our guest speaker to you. Although I know many of you know David, David Loy is a longtime friend of this community who has shared Dharma teachings with us on many occasions, and we're delighted to have him back with us this evening. David is a professor, writer, and Zen teacher in the Sambo Kyodan tradition of Zen Buddhism. He's a prolific author whose essays and books have been translated into many languages. David's articles regularly appear on the pages of Buddhist magazines, including Tricycle, Lion's Roar, and Buddha Dharma, as well as in a variety of scholarly journals. His most recent book is Ecodharma, Buddhist Teachings for the Ecological Crisis. David teaches nationally and internationally on various topics, focusing primarily on the encounter between Buddhism and modernity, what each can learn from the other. He is especially concerned about social and ecological issues. David, thanks for being with us tonight. You need to unmute.
Thank you again. Now I've lost my text. Here we go. Thank you again for the kind words and this opportunity. I'm really so happy to be with you all. And I have to say, Sangha, being together, just feels so much more important after what's happened in the last week. I also want to say I feel somewhat intimidated by the topic, so I hope that no one is expecting that I'm going to give you some clear answers about, what to do. But what I really want to do is just sort of share some thoughts that I've been having about both, why what happened, and also thinking about how we might respond. But again, just sharing some thoughts, and I hope we'll have time at the end to have a bit of a conversation about that. My guess is that I'm not the only one still in recovery, still digesting what happened exactly a week ago this evening. And one of the hardest things to understand is why so many people voted for Trump this time around. I mean, it was a bit more understandable 8 years ago, right? When he was more of an unknown, well, relatively. But how is that possible, right? I mean, where he seems to so many of us, and I don't want to assume that everyone on this Zoom agrees, but he certainly seems to me, and I'm sure most of us here, somebody who is immature in many ways and certainly far from qualified to be the most powerful man in the world. Some people did complain that they didn't really know who Kamala was, and but certainly anyone paying attention would know who Trump is. And so why did so many people vote for him? How can they be so deluded? Of course, for Buddhism, right, this is samsara. This is the world of craving, ill will, delusion. But I wonder if we can turn that around too, and maybe ask ourselves, is there perhaps some delusion that we have that has made it difficult for us to understand what's going on? Are we the ones maybe also living in a kind of a deluded or fantasy world? What is it that we have not been seeing? And why? So let me start off by talking a little bit about that and then getting into what we might do. I certainly don't want to get into the blame game, which is not a very Buddhist thing to do in any way. But I think a few introductory comments can kind of lead us into what I want to say. Number one, I think Kamala did pretty well, as well as we could expect, given the situation she was so suddenly thrown into. I mean, in retrospect, and That's always 2020. It might have been good if she'd separated herself from Biden a bit more, especially with Gaza. But to be honest, I personally doubt that that would have made all that much of a difference. I think it's really unfortunate that Biden didn't make it clear earlier, right? I mean, this last minute, he was forced into withdrawing. I mean, when he was first elected, he said he was going to be a caretaker president, only one term. So what vanity, what ego made him want to continue beyond, much beyond the point? So I think that was very unfortunate. The Democratic Party, yeah, what to say? I mean, I'm thinking they really haven't been a working class party, I think, since the days of Clinton and NAFTA. I mean, to be frank, it usually seems to me we don't have a Democratic and a Republican party. What we really have is one business party with two faces, one a little more socially liberal than the other. And I think that explains a lot when you consider the policies that are passed, why Congress does what it does. But let's turn a little bit and again, let's focus on why so many people are dissatisfied. And this is ironic given that we're sometimes told, oh, you know, this is a really great economy now. We've really bounced back since COVID. Well, we have if you're a billionaire. You know, sometimes it seems to me that this economy, and not by accident, is better at creating billionaires than looking after working class people. But let me read you something from The Guardian a couple of days ago. What might have been Trump and his supporters' strongest asset was the idea that because they're so distant and privileged, modern progressives would rather ignore questions about everyday economics. Get this statistic. Nearly 40% of all Americans say they have skipped meals in order to meet their housing payments. 40%. And more than 70% admit to living with economic anxiety. Whoa. Well, let's pause on that for a moment. Okay, and let's consider our own privileged position. You know, to be quite frank, I don't know that I have ever missed a meal because of economic anxiety. To be quite honest, it would do me good if I did, but I can't blame that I had to pay a mortgage or rent. And my guess is that for many of you too. So the question is, are we out of touch with where the situation is for most people? The article went on to say a second Trump term, of course, is hardly going to make it any better. The point is that he was able to successfully pretend that it would, right? His sense of grievance struck a chord with people who felt left behind and sneered at as deplorables or as garbage by Democratic leaders and journalists and Hollywood celebrities and so forth. But here's the point. I think that they have been left behind, right? Again, a little bit from The Guardian. Kamala Harris's brave show of positivity and her stress on inclusiveness, unity, and joy, well, jarred badly with the joyless, negative, everyday experience of conflicted and divided voters, complaining about high inflation, ruining living standards, unaffordable food, secure, well-paid jobs, rarity, cheap immigrant labor, and that their current leaders disrespect and ignore them and don't really care about them, right? This disconnect was evident in other areas. One recent poll found that 45% of all Americans say democracy isn't doing a good job protecting ordinary people. Trust in institutions such as the justice system and the media is eroding, and maybe for good reason, right? Maybe the system isn't taking good care of people. It's interesting, it's not only, I think, maybe here in the US, I mean, we've been hearing all this story about incumbents being thrown out in so many different democratic countries in the wake of COVID, which certainly had something to do with that. I'll come back to that. But I was struck to read about an academic study, okay, to no doubt elite professors studied Congress, and they concluded, quote, economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial impact on government policy, but average citizens, mass-based interest groups have little or no influence, right? Maybe a good way to focus the problem is to look at our national healthcare system, or the fact that we don't have one. There were 10 peer nations, right? Advanced developed nations were compared, and the United States was the dead last in that international comparison. And it was interesting, in declining life expectancy, I saw a chart on Facebook yesterday or the day before, and it talked about life expectancy, and it rated all the countries, and then it went year by year and how that's changing. And some, what, 30 to 40 years ago, the United States was very close to the top. And then it went year by year, and, you know, we're bouncing up and down. But by the last year, 2023, we had dropped off the chart. We were not among the top 40 in the world in terms of life expectancy. Mm-hmm. What's going on there?
Yeah.
Think about that. Someone put it very well when they said that, quote, universal healthcare is such a complex beast that only 32 of the world's 33 developed nations has been able to make it work, right? Only 32 of the 33 have been able to make it work. Where is the United States? Anyway, back to the quotation from The Guardian. People across the country have lost all faith in the American dream, the notion that hard work and self-improvement will enable you to climb up the social ladder, own a home, lay the foundations for the success of your kids and grandkids. They've lost faith simply because the dream doesn't correspond to their lived experience, right? Too many are in a constant struggle to get by month, with no end in sight in the bills and day-to-day living expenses and crippling levels of personal debt. I mean, there's other things I think we can add to that. I mean, COVID really sort of really skewed things, shook us all up. And even for so many of us, of course, ecological crisis, but even those who don't accept it, who like Trump and many of those who support him, I think many, it's like there's this kind of anxiety in the air. And I just wonder, now we have new Cold Wars with Russia and China, but something even more, let me come back. And this is where it sort of intersects, I think, more specifically with what Buddhism has to offer. If you've heard me give a talk before, you might have heard me talk about our sense of lack, right? And the way that I understand that is, as you probably know, Buddhism emphasizes anatta, no self, non-self, not self, if you will. Yeah, in modern language, we can say that the usual sense of separate self that we have, the sense that there's a me inside separate from you, this is actually a kind of psychological and social construct, right? The sense of separation from other people and from the world. And where it gets really problematical is that because this sense of self is a construct, it's really a function, it's not a thing. It's the way that mostly habitual ways of thinking and feeling and acting, it's the way that they work together to create this sense of a me that's separate from you and from the rest of the world. Because it's only a construct, it's inherently insecure. It doesn't feel real enough. Not only that, but it can't secure itself in the usual sense, which is why something like the Buddhist path is so important. You know, the ego is inherently uncomfortable. I think that's the point. Or as I like to say, we normally experience, our sense of self is shadowed by this sense of lack, by the feeling, something is wrong, something is missing, something isn't quite right with me. And at that level, it's very kind of vague, but according to circumstances, according to our culture, that's going to be focused, right? For example, in the US, very much into making money, often we have this, we often understand our sense of lack as we don't have enough money, that if we just had enough money, then everything would be okay. Or given the new media, if we were more famous, if we were a successful Facebook influencer or something like that. But basically, what happens is out of this sense of lack, this feeling of something wrong, we look for something out here and we think, oh, if I just had enough of this, then I would be okay. It would fill up the sense of lack. Unfortunately, all those things, money, fame, whatever, they're really just symptoms. Doesn't matter how much money you get, it's not going to fill up that emptiness at the core of our being. But now I'm wondering, too, don't we have, well, first of all, there's individual sense of lack, but don't we also have collective sense of lack? And I wonder, so often, because of lack, we get into these future-oriented projects. It's the nature of lack projects that right now we're not okay, but when I get what I think I need in the future, then everything will be okay. So, well, here's one example. What about the American dream? The American dream that I grew up with, you know, the one it was alluded to in one of those articles that I read, all right? Well, people don't feel the American dream is working for them anymore. They don't feel, and likewise, I remember growing up the sense that the world was getting better. Our collective lack project was progress. The world is going to get better. Do you still believe in that? What about young people, teenagers, young people? Do they believe in that? What is it like to be a teenager now? And do we really have a sense of how devastating that sense may be that no, the world isn't getting better and the opportunities for me to get ahead are not very good. And so they're, you know, people totally upset with the way things are. And of course, the tendency is going to be to throw out the incumbents who don't seem to be really addressing it. And even though we all know that Trump isn't going to solve the problem, nonetheless, he was able to, you know, people are desperate. They're looking for an alternative. They're looking for something. Even some of the people from the Middle East in places like Michigan voted for Trump because they're so angry at Biden over Gaza. And, you know, we got to try something different. It's not working, whatever is happening now. So I'm just thinking, I suspect that this is a significant factor, right? Adding to that,
David Chernikov's
the very strong sense that the world that I grew up in, my generation, a lot of things that we took for granted seem to be breaking down, seem to be falling down. And there's a kind of a huge sort of anxiety that I think tends to accompany that, right? So maybe we need to add to the three traditional poisons or the three fires of Buddhism, right? Greed, ill will, delusion. How much is it fear now? How much is it fear? And of course, fear is easily, we don't like to be fearful, especially in the US. It's we prefer to turn it into anger. You know, the fear is so let's get angry at immigrants or let's get angry at the college-educated elites who feel that they're better than we are. How much does that explain Trump's success, I wonder? Let me read a quotation from a book called Life After Doom, which I think was it's very insightful. Anyway, talking about fear, quote, "In turbulent times, people grow afraid, and their fear is a kind of psychological energy. Authoritarians are masters at manipulating the energy of fear and resentment. During collapse, as fear and resentment intensify, we should expect authoritarians to line up and become more and more popular and powerful, feeding on our fear and being fueled by our resentment. If we don't learn how to control the psychological energy of our own fear and resentment, we can be sure that others will exploit our own emotional energy for their own selfish and destructive projects." Wow. I think that points to a lot. And again, Trump is not going to solve those problems, but I think he's really good at exploiting that energy. So I'm just throwing all of that out there, just sharing sort of what I think is behind what's happened in this last week. Now, okay, moving on, what to do about it? Here, let me start with a couple Zen koans, right? First koan, the student asks the master, what should we do when difficult times come? And the master, I don't know how he gestured, but the master said, embrace them, right? Embrace them. Our path isn't about avoiding difficult times, right? And in fact, because sometimes the more difficult the times bring out the best in us, and that can be the time when we grow the most, right? Joanna Macy said, it's my experience that the world itself has a role to play in our awakening. Its very brokenness and need call to us, summoning us to walk out of the prison of self-concern. Another koan by the Chinese Chan masters, Unmon in Japanese, right? He was asked, what's the fruit of a lifetime of practice, right? All these years meditating and so forth. And he said, responding appropriately. We are enabled to respond appropriately, right? In this case, it's clearly not simply about hiding on our cushions and finding a cave where we can meditate, but being engaged as best we can, right? And when we put those two little mondo, little stories together, I mean, it's clear. I think the single most important thing that Buddhism has to offer, and I think it's unique as far as I know, it's wonderful. It's the Bodhisattva path, right? Double-sided. We continue to work on our own practice, on our own liberation, on our own transformation, but we know that's not enough because as we practice, we become more and more aware that we're not separate from other people, we're not separate from the world, that our own suffering and our own liberation are not separate from what's going on with other people, that we're all interconnected, we're all part of something bigger, right? So, Bodhisattva path, but hey, where do we start? Well, one good place to start, I think, is taking a look at the three tenets of the Zen peacemakers, right? First one, not knowing, which is letting go of fixed ideas about ourselves, about others, and about the universe, right? In Zen, we emphasize this, and we talk about don't know mind, right? Right? Includes don't identify with the thoughts and the feelings that come up. I read recently somebody said, when most people are thinking, they're not really thinking, they're judging. So let's be careful not to judge, right? Or don't cling to the judging ideas when they do arise. I like the way Swami Beyondananda put it. The best way to face the unknown is by not knowing. We have this Zen koan, not knowing is most intimate. One of the students was on pilgrimage going around, and the master asked him, why do you do this? Why are you going around on pilgrimage? And he said, I don't know. And the master said, ah, don't knowing is most intimate, right? Roshi Egyoku Nagao describes it as a flash of openness, a sudden shift to be present in the moment in which we take shelter in. I would say we open up to the place before anything arises, place of emptiness, silence. We become more spacious, more aware of our own reactivity, more open to the perspectives of others. And this isn't a fixed position, this not knowing, but it's a way of engaging with the world right here and now. We don't know what's going to happen next. But we do the best we can according to our understanding of the situation and ready to change what we do and what we think as circumstances change or as our understanding of the circumstances change, right? One of my teachers, Robert Aiken, liked to say, our task isn't to clear up the mystery, but to make the mystery clear. So this path we're on, this spiritual path, is not about, oh, now we understand everything, now it's all clear. Oh, no, it's more opening up to experience this mysterious, sacred world where everything is changing, whether we know it or not, right? And for those on the path, this doesn't have to be debilitating. There's something empowering about it because it liberates us from dogmatism and our usual fixed ideas, right? But let me push this a little more. It's not simply about not knowing. I think more the not knowing feeds into something else that I think we need to really remember and appreciate, which is not controlling, right? Here I'm quoting from that same book I mentioned earlier. Quote, "The ultimate thing that we cannot control is, well, life. The ultimate addiction is to our own capacity to control. These three things, uncertainty, impermanence, and powerlessness, lie at the heart of this collective global teachable moment," right? Uncertainty, impermanence, and powerlessness. We cannot know, that's the uncertainty, or control the powerlessness of our world because it's inherently relational, impermanent. Every moment is pregnant with possibility, fraught with danger and mystery too. So, and here's the paradox that our practice can help us appreciate. Paradoxically, it's when we can be at ease with uncertainty, when we can accept our own powerlessness, our own lack of control in the sense of what happens, then we become free. And can we say, is this getting really at the heart of the Buddhist path? By powerlessness, I don't mean, you know, there's nothing we can do in response to what's happening in Washington, but this general sense of, you know, how much control we have is very, very limited. And our responding appropriately is not about sort of being able or trying to control things, right? So that's the first of the Zen peacemaker tenets. The second one, bearing witness to the joys and suffering of the world. And in a way, the first part of my talk, I suppose you could say, was a kind of attempt to bear witness to, I think, some of the things that are going on that have led to the situation that we're now in, right? It means seeing all the aspects of the situation, including our own attachments and judgments. And you've just heard my judgments. You cannot live solely in a state of not knowing because life is asking us to face the conditions that are coming at us by being present to them. When you bear witness, you open to the uniqueness of what's arising and meet it just as it is. And combined with not knowing, bearing witness can strengthen our capacity for spaciousness, enabling us to be present to the very things that make us feel as if we've lost our center or lost control. It can strengthen our capacity to listen to other point of views, leading to a more nuanced understanding of our situation. So bearing witness, being open. Again, that follows so well from not knowing because we don't know what we think we know, right? We're kind of open, and then we're going to be bearing witness more in response. And then thirdly, taking action that arises from knowing and bearing witness, right? Taking action. But what action, right? What should we do? I think it's pretty clear this is a time that calls for stronger sanghas and becoming more engaged, but that's just a general perspective. More specifically, what should we do? I'm reminded what happened after I wrote the book on Ecodharma. Some people liked it and they contacted me. They said, I want to be an ecosattva. What should I do? Even though I think the book says somewhere, you know, the Buddhist path doesn't give us specific answers because our situation today is so different from that of the Buddhist time. So what I came up with was three questions that I think can be very helpful. Three contemplations, if you will. that can help people decide for themselves. And when I first thought about them, I was thinking in individual terms. Since then, people have told me that they can actually work very well in groups. People can come together and reflect, meditate, discuss them. So anyway, here are the three questions, which to me, you could say are kind of the answer to how to be a bodhisattva in our time. Number one, we begin by reflecting in our own situation what it is that we have to offer. And that means taking account of everything about our situation, our age, our health, our gender, our race, given that that can sometimes make a difference, right? Our abilities, our skills, our education, our jobs. Are we retired? Do we need money? Are there other people dependent on us? How much time do we have? All of that. We need to reflect on that because we all have responsibilities as well as, you know, personal responsibilities, as well as, I would say, a responsibility to try to respond to the bigger picture. The second contemplation or reflection, reflecting on the possibilities available to you in this situation. So taking account of what we have to offer, what are the good possibilities? Might even involve some kind of research. Often it would involve becoming more aware of, say, problems in the area where you're living. But given the internet, that wouldn't necessarily be the case. Sometimes it means being part of a national movement. But the basic issue is there are so many things that can be done. There are so many things that need to be done. The danger is spreading ourselves too thin, burning out. And so we really need to think through, you know, what are the good possibilities and be very clear about that given our situation. And then thirdly, finally, and the most important, I think, having done those first two contemplations, taking time to really do them thoroughly, kind of put them on a shelf and ask ourselves, treat this third question as kind of a koan, the koan of, you know, what tugs at my heart, right? What do I really feel drawn to do, right? And of course, if we're responding to that, and I have to say, I think that's where the meditation becomes so important, because it's going to help us get beyond. It's not just rational calculation of positives and negatives and possibilities, but it's opening up. And I think often people feel it's not that they make a decision, but that in the meditation on this question, it becomes clear what they really want to do. I think that's why the meditation here can be so valuable. So, and to say it again, I'm really pleased that some groups find that this is very, very beneficial. I remember when I first moved back from Japan to Cincinnati, we started what was then called a Buddhist Peace Fellowship group. And what really brought the group together was doing things together, right? It's not just sort of talking, but actually doing something. And there was something very powerful about that. So this as a group exercise, I think, could be really important, given that I think one of the consequences we're in now is that we really do need stronger sanghas. Let me emphasize, though, as the final point of emphasis is that, and again, this is something that the Bodhisattva path enables, the meditation enables. What we need to do is to do the very best we can, but acting without attachment to the results of what we do. As the Buddha says in the Pali Canon, that the characteristics of an awakened person are his or her actions are without expectation, right? Sometimes even said without hope. In the Tibetan Lojong training, there's a version of this, aphorism 28. Abandon any hope or expectation of fruition. Don't get caught up in how you're going to be in the future. Stay in the present moment, right? Those of you who are familiar with the Bhagavad Gita, that most popular Hindu text, right? It talks about different paths to God, and one of them is karma yoga, right? The path of action. But the most important thing about karma yoga is non-attachment, no personal gain, but non-attachment in general. Your right is to the work, it says, never to the fruits. I don't know if we have any Tolkien fans here, but there's a great passage in The Lord of the Rings where Frodo says, "I wish it need not have happened in my time." "So do I," said Gandalf, "and so do all who live to see such times, but that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us." Interesting, Joanna Macy says just the opposite. "I feel so fortunate to be alive now. People might think I'm crazy, but just speaking personally, it's an incredible thing to be alive with my fellow humans at a time, at this time. Right now, we can be here to honor life." Ram Dass, Baba Ram Dass, once said, "I've been asked many times whether this is the Aquarian age and it's all just beginning, or if this is Armageddon and this is the end. And I have to admit, I don't know. But whichever way it goes, my work is the same. My work is to quiet my mind and open my heart and relieve suffering wherever I find it." May that be the work for all of us, yeah? So this points to the deepest meaning of non-attachment. Our task is to do the very best we can, right? Don't know mine. Not knowing what the consequences will be, not knowing whether our efforts will make any difference whatsoever. And is it already too late in some ways? Ecologically, have we passed tipping points? Civilization as we know it is doomed? We don't know. But it's okay that we don't know. Of course, there's intention. We try to be strategic. But ultimately, we, again, that lack of control. We're very limited how much control we have. And you could say, ultimately, what we do is our gift to each other, ecologically, our gift to the earth. You know, I say gift because when you give a gift, if you have an expectation of return, it's not a real gift, is it? It's a kind of quid pro quo. We don't know if what we do is important, will be important. We don't know that, we can't know that, but it's important that we do it. Of course, to be so unattached to the results of what we do, I'm not saying that's easy, but again, we have this practice, meditation. So when we do, when we are attached, when we are frustrated, when we are feeling burned out, guess what? We can return to our practice. We can return to meditation. Maybe none of us can embody this non-attachment to results fully, but again, we're not called upon to be perfect. Rather, we're called upon to do the best that we can. What is it that really enables us to act without attachment to results? I think there's a really important one-word answer here, okay? What motivates us? Love. I came across a quotation, a couple different names, Richard Brendan maybe. Anyway, the quotation is, "The world doesn't want to be saved. It wants to be loved. That's how you save it." You know, if the love is there, we're going to, even we don't know the results, but it doesn't matter. We're still going to be called upon to do the best we can. Let me read a quotation from Derek Jensen about why I'm an activist. He was asked that. "Why am I an activist? Because I'm in love with salmon, with trees outside my window, with the animals. And if you love, you act to defend. And if you love, you act to defend your beloved. Of course, results matter, but they don't matter to whether you make the effort. You don't simply hope your beloved is going to survive and thrive. You do what it takes. And if my love doesn't cause me to protect those I love, then it's not love. And if I don't act to protect my land base, I'm not fully human. Howard Zinn, in his book, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, said, "Human history is a history not only of cruelty, but of compassion, sacrifice, courage, kindness. What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. If we see only the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. If we remember those times and places, and there are many, where people have behaved magnificently, then this gives us the energy to act, and at least the possibility of sending this spinning top of a world in a different direction. And if we do act, in however small a way," he continues, "we don't have to wait for some grand utopian future. The future is an infinite succession of present moments. And to live now as we think human beings should live, in defiance of all that's bad around us, is itself a marvelous victory." He might have been responding especially to the Vietnam War, which was, the big issue at the time I was growing up. Seems like we're in not such a different situation now. Let me end by quoting somebody else called Tom Rivett Carnac in that book I mentioned earlier. "You have the biggest opportunity in all of human history to live an incredibly meaningful life." The biggest opportunity in all of human history. For me, this plugs into what Chomsky said, right? That this is the most dangerous time in human history. The actions that you take because of the accident of the time of your birth are of an order of magnitude in importance compared to most people who've lived before. Order of magnitude 10 times, right? The actions we take today because we're here right now are 10 times more important than most people who've lived before because you are going to affect the future of life on Earth. The future of life in 50, in 500, maybe 500,000 years, by what you do in the next couple decades. So no one is asking for an easy life. Really deep down, we're asking for a meaningful life. And goodness knows the situation we're thrown on today, thrown into now. A lot of opportunity for a meaningful life. Okay. Thank you for listening. I hope we have a little bit of time to, David, do we have some time to maybe open
We
up for some
do.
discussion?
We've got about 15 minutes. I know most of you are familiar with the Zoom platform, but if by chance you're not, you can comment or ask a question of David in one of two ways. One would be to go to the bar at the bottom of your screen, click on the React button, and that will show you an icon that says Raise Hand. I'll see that you've raised your hand and invite you to unmute so David and everyone else can hear you. Alternatively, if you'd like to put a comment in the chat, a question in the chat, I'll monitor that and let David know if there's something there that he can respond to.
I'm looking at the chat right now. Sylvie asked me to repeat the last quote. There's so many quotes. I assume that's the Tom one. What might be better is, Sylvie, if you send me an email, through my website or anyone else, I'm happy to, if there's a quote you want, just let me know and I'm happy to send it to you or anything else that I was saying in this talk. So then you'll have a copy for yourself. But yeah.
There'll also be a recording of this talk that I'll be sending to David at the end of the evening, which will be posted perhaps on your website, David, I would guess, huh?
Yeah, we'll do that. Yeah, thank you, David.
So if people wanted to listen again or share this talk with others, they could point people to your website once you get it posted.
Shouldn't take long. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. I see I've got a hand up. Could you go ahead, please, Piero?
Hello, David. Thank you. Hello, both Davids. Thank you so much for this opportunity. David Law, you didn't talk too much about the media and the pernicious use of lies, the dissemination of misinformation. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sounds to me like you might be able to do a good job, Piero. I'm
No,
serious. I'm serious. Yeah, for sure.
don't escape from it. I mean,
Yeah.
what's your take about the influence of right-wing media, for instance, or the dissemination of misinformation, the creation of ignorance and delusion?
Speaking more generally, traditional Buddhism talks about the three poisons or the three fires, right? Greed, ill will, delusion. And I think we need to recognize that in our time they have become institutionalized, that is to say, not only collective, but they've taken on a life of their own. So I would include, I'm sorry, this is not giving an answer what to do, but I would say our economic system as it functions now, corporate consumer capital, I think that capitalist system is institutionalized greed. If greed means you never have enough, more profitability, more consume, more whatever, grow on a finite planet. I think that our militarism is, and often our attitude toward immigrants, documented and un or un especially undocumented, and police brutality. I think sometimes that's institutionalized ill will, remembering that we spend, if you really add it all up together, about $1 trillion a year on our military, which makes us by far the most militarized society in human history. And then thirdly, yeah, collectivized, institutionalized ignorance. Sometimes I think about it in terms of advertising, but fundamentally what you're pointing to is the internet especially, and the kind of media that we have now, social media, have become extremely powerful, and that people are starting to become very, very clever at exploiting that. So, in a way, I'm not giving an answer, Piero, because I don't have an answer, except to say that this is one of those collective problems that are going to require a collective responses, that it's a new situation. Traditional Buddhism doesn't talk about it. So clearly it's a problem. How we respond to that problem is something we're going to need to be creative about. But since you asked the question, what would you say? What do you suggest? Where would you go with it?
It pains me that people who know the truth are so greedy, as you said, that they make their lives, just spreading lies that they know that the things that they are saying is not true, and even that they are creating pain and suffering for so many. So it's difficult for me to see, people spreading lies the way that they do. And they do because they're making money out of it. So there are big corporations that's what they do. They say things that are not true. They steer the people to be hateful, actually. They create division, they create separation, they create the us versus them mentality, and they live with that. I don't know how they can sleep at night. Sometimes we say that. I don't know how you can sleep at night. You're creating all this division in the world, not only in America, but in the world, because what happens here filters down to other
Yeah.
countries as well. As you
Very
know, I'm
quickly,
Brazilian.
usually. Yeah.
As you know, I am Brazilian, and I have lived in a dictatorship. I only I was born in 1953 and I only voted for president when I was 39 years old because of the military coup in Brazil. Yeah, let's say also sponsored by the United States, right?
There we go.
With the fear of communism.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm depressed, I'm devastated, I am disgusted, I am all these things. I'm trying to process this. I think you did a good job explaining to us the reality, but
what to do.
My point is that people know what they are doing, but they keep doing. And let's see what this is going to unfold. We're going to keep doing what we can. I think that, just to add, I think that meditation itself is powerful political activism, because it's the work that we do, that changing ourselves and presenting ourselves differently in society is what is going to give us a chance of creating a better world. Perhaps
I agree with that, but the meditation by, and there are some people who think, you know, the meditation by itself changes the world, and the only thing I need to do is to meditate more. And I think there's a kind of mythology there that's a bit dangerous. That definitely is an important part of it, but nonetheless, we also need to use the stability and the energy and the non-attachment to results that is created in our meditation in actually getting out there and doing what we can. And I know the Shodo has her hand up. Thank you, Piero.
Thank you, David.
Wow, thank you. So, David, I am really grateful. I have been off balance all week and consuming information like mad. And you took it back to practice, and that was really helpful to me. There's a thing that I'm starting to think, and I think it might be relevant to the important things that Piero said. I am no longer assuming that the election was honest and that Trump actually had a majority of the votes. And I'm slowly collecting. It occurred, I think, I don't know if it was Wednesday morning or Thursday morning that I woke up going, wait a second, why are we believing this? Because I was involved with the George Bush election integrity issues. And so I gathered something, and then I heard something from someone else, and then I heard about places that are suing because a lot of ballots are missing. And then so I'm not going to put all this stuff out there. But I think the important thing about the appearance that a majority of people voted for him is the incredible disheartenment and discouragement that we feel when we think that our neighbors knowingly voted for a monster. Excuse the expression, and that there are people who think that I knowingly voted for Monster because I voted for Harris, and the only ethical thing, you know, was to vote for a third party or stay home. And, you know, I sometimes have that conversation, and I just had another one, but basically those are not the people who swing the election.
You know, I think we need to be a little bit careful. I also have my suspicions, but unless there's evidence, it's so tricky that we're just going to reciprocate what happened 4 years ago. And, you know, because we want it to be that way, we'd all be happier in one way to know that people weren't that way, you know. But I think we have to be really, really careful without some evidence, not going too far down that rabbit hole.
Right. We have to do not knowing.
Exactly.
But not knowing is different from being certain that I live in a deep red district, being certain that I can't trust anybody on my street. And I'm quite afraid, actually. I'm literally afraid.
I think all of us are afraid in one way and another now, you know.
Right.
What happened to our country, you know? What this is 4 years, you know, 8 years ago. But we really didn't know what this guy is like. What does it say about, what does it say about our country? What does it say about people? What does it say about the media that, you know, that Piero was asking about? It's scary. It's a very scary time. A kind of world view. The world is a certain kind of way. Reality is a certain kind of way. And now this is kind of shaking everything up. And if we're not afraid, we're probably not paying attention. Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you there. But I'm just, it's like I've decided that I need to mention that there are questions. And if people want, I send them to resources. But I won't do that here.
Can I share with you all one more quote from that book?
Please.
The author was talking to a woman who said, she was talking about hope. And she said, "I used to think that hope was the confidence that what I was afraid of wouldn't happen. Now I think that hope is the confidence that although what I fear may happen, but that I don't have to be afraid. Although what I fear may happen, I don't have to, I'll be able to cope. I'll be able to deal with it, to respond appropriately." I was struck by that.
Wow, that's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Shona.
David, we're coming up on 9 o'clock. If there's a short comment or question anyone has, we've got time for that, but not for a long discussion. So let me just check in and see, and otherwise we can go ahead and do a closing. Kevin, go ahead, if you would, and unmute, and please keep it on the brief side, if you would.
Certainly. I'm afraid of clinging to the Dharma and the instruction or the guidance that we read about, and locking myself in to, you know, locking myself into the Eightfold Path, knowing that the suffering is going to increase. And the balance between clinging to those teachings, you know, clinging obviously, you know, creates more suffering. So that's a dilemma that I am confronting right now.
Well, I mean, here I'm reminded of, you know, that famous line where the Buddha talks about his teachings as a raft. And, you know, that includes all the Eightfold Path, right? All his teachings are a raft. And, you know, we can cling to the raft, but ultimately the raft is to help us go somewhere. And we're in a situation now where it can't just be about us individually, but collectively, where do we want to go? Where, you know, what are we going to do? And that's why I think it kind of opens up very naturally to the Bodhisattva path, which is, it's all about skillful means. It's not about clinging, you know, to the Eightfold Path at all. In fact, in the Mahayana, they don't even talk about the Eightfold Path. They talk about the personal qualities that we need to develop, like generosity, you know, endurance, perseverance, morality. You know, they talk about these qualities that we develop that are going to enable us to really get out there and be engaged. And it just seems more and more clear to me now that the path is being fully engaged and doing what we can in the most dangerous time in human history, where what we do could be extraordinarily important, but we don't know. So we do the best we can, not attached to results. And to be frank, I feel like right now we're all being called to do that. And in a way, we're lucky because this whole question of the meaning of life, you know, so many people find it meaningless. Oh my God, you know, it's given to us in a platter. Do what we can. Yeah.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Kevin. Yeah. Thank you all.
Thank you, David, once again for your helpful words and good food for thought and for our hearts. Let's take just a few moments for a very brief dedication of merit. If you'd like to find an appropriate posture that allows you to feel wakeful, connected to yourself and to the world. For a few moments, let me invite you to let go of the words and concepts that we've shared and talked about, trusting that those that are important to you and helpful to you will be available to you when you need them. And let's come back into the simple presence that I talked about when we began the meditation. Take a moment and drop down from the mind into the heart and sense the body in the room that you're currently in, on the life force that animates every one of us. Take a nice intentional deep breath or two into the heart center at the center of your chest. As a lot of us know, I think this is the place that in the perennial wisdom teachings is said to be the place in which we can be separated from our separateness and can sense and feel and experientially know what Thich Nhat Hanh so beautifully called interbeing. It's from this place of interbeing that we intuitively can understand what David said about the Bodhisattva path, that we work on ourselves so that we can simultaneously find more joy and happiness and well-being in our own lives, and in doing so, become greater and more effective instruments of happiness and joy and well-being in the world as we move through it. These words I'll close with were written by a friend I studied with many years ago at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, a woman named Kathleen McTeague. May the light around us guide our footsteps and hold us fast to the highest vision we seek. May the darkness around us nurture our dreams and give us rest so that we may give ourselves to the work of the world. Let us seek to remember the wholeness of our lives, the weaving of light and shadow in this great and astonishing dance in which we move. May it be so. Blessed be. Amen. Want to thank everyone who chose to join us this evening. And as is our custom here at the end, if you'd like to share a brief phrase or a word to exit, say goodbye, or greet a friend, we usually each week create a little bit of mindful, joyful chaos before we close. So if you'd like to share a comment, feel free to unmute, and we'll see what kind of music we can make with our voices if they're happening at the same time. Thanks to everyone for being with us this evening. Thank you, David, once again.
Thank you, David, and everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Good to be here with you all.
Yep.
Thank you both.
David and David.
Thank you all.
David and David. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Peace.
Bye. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Bless.
Bye bye, Deb.
Yeah.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David Loy. I will take refuge in the Dharma and not cling to the Dharma. Thank you.
May we become the Dharma.
Everybody be well.
Bye bye,
see
everybody.
See you next time when the time is right.